From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Ukraine crisis. Unity government launched in Palestinian reconciliation deal. Cameroon soldiers killed dozens of Boko Haram fighters, plus a cholera outbreak in South Sudan. Ukrainian military officials say rebels have launched a major attack on a border patrol base in the eastern region at the center of an escalating fight with pro-Russian separatists. VOA's Gabe Joslow is in Kiev with our report.
A spokesman for Ukraine's so-called anti-terror operations, Vladislav Selesnyov, says about 200 men attacked a border patrol post overnight in the Luhansk region using small arms and machine guns. Selesnyov says at the same time, snipers fired at the border patrol from positions in a nearby tower block. He says Ukrainian forces suffered some injuries. The battles lasted into the day Monday. The spokesman said the military called in air support, but the aircraft were unable to fire on rebels who had taken positions near civilians. He says just as the air assault started, the rebel fighters hid in a residential building adjacent to their base. From there, Selesnyov says, they watched until the government aircraft left, then they came back and continued shooting. Ukrainian media report 5 militants were killed during the battle and 10 border guards were injured. Ukraine is stepping up its fight against pro-Russian separatists who have taken control of some areas in Luhansk and neighboring Donetsk province. Fighters from across the border in Russia have been seen among the rebels, though Moscow denies any involvement. In a separate development, Russia's state-run gas company, Gazprom, has delayed for 1 week the threatened shutoff of supplies to Ukraine after Kiev paid some of its debt to Moscow. The two sides have been engaged in discussions in Brussels to reach a solution to a pricing dispute. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Kiev.
Against the backdrop of the ongoing violence in Ukraine, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Monday that Russia is submitting a draft UN Security Council resolution calling for the creation of humanitarian corridors in eastern Ukraine to allow residents to escape the fighting. Lavrov told reporters the resolution also calls for an end to the ongoing violence in the region and said the situation there is worsening.
He said our Western colleagues have been telling us for quite a long time that as soon as the presidential election is held in Ukraine, the situation will calm down. But everything is happening, he said, exactly the opposite way. And at the U.S. State Department here in Washington, spokesperson Jennifer Psaki criticized Russia's proposal for an emergency meeting of the U.N. Security Council to introduce that resolution aimed at an immediate ceasefire in Ukraine.
On the proposal, the UN proposal, it is hypocritical of the Russian leadership to call for an end to violence and the creation of humanitarian corridors, when at the same time, armed irregular forces are entering Ukraine from Russia, weapons are being brought illegally from Russia into Ukraine, Russian-backed separatists are attacking new targets and holding OSCE monitoring teams hostage, and Russia is doing nothing to stop these activities.
Meantime, the office of British Prime Minister David Cameron announced that he will hold a face-to-face meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin on Friday in Normandy, France, where both will attend events marking the 70th anniversary of World War II's D-Day landings. And later in the program, British veterans of D-Day gather to remember the 1944 Normandy landings.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas has sworn in a unity government under a reconciliation deal with the rival Hamas group. VOA's Scott Bob reporting from Jerusalem.
Mahmoud Abbas, who also heads the mainstream Fatah Palestinian group, presented the reconciliation government at his headquarters in Ramallah. He says the government is a temporary one, and its duty is to prepare for elections soon, in addition to its duty to help the people. He said the new ministers are technocrats and independents, and that none of them belonged to either Fatah or Hamas. He added the new government would abide by commitments made by previous Palestinian administrations and by agreements ratified by the Umbrella Palestine Liberation Organization. The elections are aimed at ending a split with Hamas that began when Hamas seized control of the Gaza Strip 7 years ago. Hamas is not a member of the PLO. It opposes negotiations with Israel, which it wants to destroy. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his government would not negotiate with any Palestinian group that included Hamas. He said he is calling on all responsible elements in the international community not to hurry and recognize a Palestinian government that included Hamas. Mr. Netanyahu said Hamas is a terrorist organization that calls for the destruction of Israel, and this will not strengthen peace, but rather strengthen terror. Mr. Abbas announced a reconciliation deal was imminent after talks broke down with Israel over reviving the stalled Middle East peace negotiations. Fatah and Hamas announced they were reconciling nearly 2 years ago, but implementation of the deal encountered many obstacles. Israel, following the Hamas takeover in Gaza, imposed a blockade on the enclave that crippled its economy and caused frequent shortages of basic goods. Gazans survived in large part on humanitarian aid and hundreds of smuggling tunnels into Egypt. Most of the tunnels were destroyed after the coup last year that brought the military to power in Egypt. The new Egyptian government considers Hamas to be an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, which it has vowed to destroy. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Libya's new Prime Minister, Ahmad Matik, held his first official cabinet meeting Monday after police helped him take over the office that his predecessor had refused to leave. Libya has been embroiled in months of violence and political turmoil, and outgoing Prime Minister Abdullah Al-Thani had refused to hand over power. In a brief statement after the cabinet meeting, Mr. Matik announced fighting between militant Islamists and a renegade general left at least 20 people dead in the eastern city of Benghazi. The American husband of a Sudanese woman sentenced to death for refusing to renounce her Christian faith might have to provide DNA proof that he is the father of her two children. State Department spokesperson Jennifer Psaki here in Washington acknowledged that Daniel Wani is a U.S. citizen after he waived his right to privacy and said he was receiving help from the U.S. Embassy in Khartoum.
We do have a Privacy Act waiver for Mr. Wani at this time, who I can confirm is a U.S. citizen, as has been reported. We have been engaged with him since June of 2013, so for the last year, and we've been in regular contact with him throughout the trial. Embassy officials most recently met with him on June 2nd, so that is today. And one of our top priorities, as all of you know, is the protection of U.S. citizens overseas. And our continued engagement with him and efforts to assist him as a U.S. citizen are indicative of that commitment.
Wani's wife, Mariam Yaha Ibrahim, who is a Christian like her husband, was sentenced to death on May 15th under Islamic law that has been in place since 1983. Ibrahim was raised by her Christian mother, but her father was Muslim, and under Islamic law, children are considered to be of the faith of their fathers, and any conversions are not allowed. While in prison, Ibrahim gave birth last week to her second child, a girl. Their 20-month-old son is also in prison with his mother. Wani wants to confer U.S. citizenship to his children. This requires DNA proof of relationship. Police in Nigeria have banned protests in the capital demanding that the government rescue more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped by Islamist militants. Officials say the decision was made because of security reasons. They say the protest in Abuja could be hijacked by what they call dangerous elements. Demonstrators denounced the move and vowed to challenge the ban in court. Protests in Abuja have been taking place almost daily, part of a campaign to keep attention on the kidnapping and to pressure the government to rescue the girls. State Radio in Cameroon reports that Cameroon's military has killed at least 60 Boko Haram members who crossed over from Nigeria seeking refuge. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
The 60 heavily armed Boko Haram members reportedly killed in the village of Dabanga in far northern Cameroon crossed over from Borno State in Nigeria, according to Cameroon's national radio, which said they were ambushed by Cameroonian soldiers. The governor of the far north region of Cameroon, Fonka Awa, says his office had received information that some Boko Haram members might be hiding in Cameroonian villages and asked for specialized troops to be deployed. He told VOA that the military had done a good job.
Of course, yes, without mincing words. After such a situation, you reassemble the forces and map out strategies. You galvanize them and put them back into action. And I think that's what we've just done.
Ebenezer Akanga, a journalist who works with Cameroon's national broadcaster, told VOA in a telephone interview that if military had carried out similar attacks in the past, Boko Haram would not be using Cameroon as a safe haven.
The opinion many people hold is that from the beginning, the government seemed to have been caressing the Boko Harams. The government didn't seem to have taken this fight very seriously. This is what was expected to be done from the very word go. In fact, if the military had this type of reaction, it would have deterred the Boko Harams from crossing to Cameroonian territory. Heavy military arsenal and also troops have been deployed in the far north region, stating that the government is determined to take this fight to the Boko Haram camp and to discourage the Boko Harams from coming to the far north region.
Akanga says security forces from Cameroon and Nigeria should work together to eliminate Boko Haram from the two countries.
The military has to adopt different strategies because now it doesn't simply suffice chasing away the Boko Harams. The fight needs to be taken to their very backyard. Even if officially there may not be agreements authorizing the Cameroon military to cross to the Nigerian territory, I personally think that this fight cannot be won by fighting the Boko Harams only in the Cameroon territory. The fight should be taken to their own camp out there in Nigeria.
Last month, Nigeria's neighbors Cameroon and Chad both declared war on Boko Haram. Cameroon has since deployed 2,000 troops along its borders with Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzika, VOA News, Yaoundé.
World Health Organization reports that cholera is spreading rapidly in South Sudan's capital city, Juba. WHO says aid agencies and the Ministry of Health are intensifying efforts to stop the spread of this disease in the city and to prevent outbreaks in other parts of the country. Lisa Schlein reporting from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization is worried at how quickly cholera has spread in South Sudan's capital since the disease was first confirmed on April 23rd. It reports more than 1,000 cases, including 27 deaths in Juba, with unconfirmed cases reported in other parts of this war-torn country, including in Jonglei, Lakes, and Upper Nile states. A WHO specialist in cholera, Dr. Dominique Legros, says the unsanitary conditions of the displaced persons' camps and the onset of the rainy season are expected to accelerate the spread of this often fatal disease.
I think that we have to be ready for a situation of a large epidemic, if you want to call it an epidemic, in the country. It's very difficult to predict how outbreaks of cholera evolve. We know that they go very fast, and we have seen this again this time in Juba. For the moment, outside Juba, we don't see so far big outbreaks.
Legault says controlling the outbreak in more remote areas will be complicated during the rainy season as roads become impassable, cutting off access. He says this period usually provokes an upsurge in cholera cases due to flooding that contaminates water sources. Cholera spreads through contaminated food and water. It causes severe vomiting and acute diarrhea, which can lead to dehydration. It can kill within hours if left untreated, but most cases are successfully treated with oral rehydration salts. Legault says two main strategies are in place for containing the disease. In Juba, he says, aid workers are trying to improve sanitation and provide safe water. He says they also are setting up treatment centers so people can easily access health care.
Then outside Juba, we have a system in place that was already in place before that we have reinforced with notably rapid tests for cholera to detect as early as possible upsurge of cholera cases, beginning of outbreaks, so that we can try to contain them. And of course, in similar settings, preposition material for treatment and staff when needed.
Legault says security concerns because of the ongoing war hamper efforts to control the disease. For example, an evening curfew in Juba limits movement, making it difficult for both cholera patients and healthcare workers to go to treatment centers. He says a few weeks ago, WHO and partners vaccinated displaced people at a camp in the northern part of South Sudan. But because of heightened security, health workers are not able to return to the camp to carry out a second round. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And Somalia, again facing growing food insecurity. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization blames it on late rains, a poor harvest, and ongoing conflict. VOA's Joda Capua reports.
It's estimated 800,000 Somalis currently are in need of food aid. Of those, 200,000 are described as malnourished children under age 5. Senior economist Shukri Ahmed says $18 million is needed over the next 90 days to scale up rapid interventions.
These 3 months are very important, actually, because this is what we call the hunger season. It is usually just before the main harvest. The main harvest starts in August. And this is when you would have depleted your stocks from the earlier crop, which this year was also not very good. It was relatively poor.
Ahmed says Somalia has some fundamental and chronic problems affecting its food supply.
Whenever there is some escalation of one or the other, we raise these alarms. It could be the security situation that goes from bad to worse in certain cases, and in others it is the rainfall situation and drought conditions again rearing their head, and in others it is a combination of these things coming together.
He says such combinations proved to be deadly in the past in Somalia. It's not clear whether the late and erratic rainfall is due to climate change. Ahmed says that would require further study. The current conditions, though, are well known in the region.
Generally, the Eastern Africa, particularly Horn of Africa, what we know as Somalia, parts of Ethiopia, parts of Kenya, and even parts of Tanzania, have this erratic rainfall, and every now and then there is this drought happening. But now that we don't have infrastructure on the ground, the small irrigation systems that we have broken in Somalia and all this are coming together actually to create havoc on food security.
The late and erratic Gu rains, which normally occur from April through June, followed January's poor harvest in southern Somalia. Maize and sorghum prices have risen between 60 and 80%.
There was this escalation of conflict in main producing areas, so it didn't give farmers enough time, actually, to prepare their land and to harvest.
AU, Kenyan, and Somali forces continue to battle the militant group Al-Shabaab. The FAO senior economist says Somalis have done their best to cope.
Somalis are resilient people. Generally, through trade and through exchange and through markets, they were able actually to absorb most of these shocks.
He says the estimated $1 billion in remittances from Somalis abroad were also crucial. The rapid intervention programs for Somalia include distribution of seeds and vouchers for fertilizers and the use of tractors, pest and disease prevention and control, and a temporary cash for work project to rebuild some infrastructure.
The canals, the irrigation, and working on those and rehabilitating them so that whatever rain comes, farmers and others would be able to use them. So the creation of employment is for the productive part, the productive assets of the people, which then helps the livelihoods of the population.
Another part of the rapid intervention includes the restocking of livestock for about 4,000 pastoralists. The FAO expects conditions to improve slightly in Somalia in August and September, when the next harvest should be ready. It says the GOO rains resumed in early May, but would have to continue through the end of June to prevent food security conditions from getting worse. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians. This
with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
British veterans of the D-Day landings made a nostalgic return to the warship that played a pivotal role in the operation, the HMS Belfast. On Monday, several dozen survivors attended a ceremony on board the ship, now floating a museum in the River Thames. 70 years ago, HMS Belfast was part of a huge armada numbering thousands of vessels that crossed the sea from England to the Normandy coast. Edward Cordery, now 90 years old, spent 2 years on the Belfast as a torpedo operator, and on D-Day he worked as a crane driver to bring on board the casualties from the beaches.
90% of them were past help. That's the sad thing of it, because the conditions of getting them to the ship weren't good from their survival point of view, you know. But we just did it in the hope that they would survive, but most of them came back on deck and were just by the side.
During a ceremony on Monday, the veterans met with Prime Minister David Cameron.
70 years ago, you did your country proud, and your country will always, always be immensely proud of you. Thank you.
President Obama heading to Europe with stops planned in Poland, Belgium, and France, where he'll speak on Friday at Omaha Beach in Normandy for a ceremony marking the anniversary of D-Day. Also in the news, Spain's King Juan Carlos is stepping down from the throne, clearing the way for his son, Prince Felipe, to take over. Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy made the abdication announcement on Monday on national television, followed a few hours later by the king himself.
Por todo ello, guiado por el convencimiento de prestar el mejor servicio a los españoles,
King Juan Carlos said, because he is guided by his conviction to serve all the people of Spain in the best manner, he believes the nation deserves to be led by a younger generation. It was not immediately clear when the abdication will be taking place, allowing the 46-year-old Felipe to assume power. 76-year-old Juan Carlos oversaw his country's transition from dictatorship to democracy, coming into power in 1975, just 2 days after the death of longtime dictator Francisco Franco. Juan Carlos's popularity, though, has been deeply eroded by scandals swirling around him and his family. He went on a luxury elephant safari to Botswana in the middle of Spain's financial crisis, during which he broke his hip and had to be flown back to Spain for medical treatment aboard a private jet. His image has long been tarnished by the investigation also of his son-in-law, who is suspected of embezzling large amounts in public contracts. FIFA's top two officials, Sepp Blatter and Jerome Valcke, handed over the World Cup trophy to the Brazil World Cup officials on Monday ahead of the tournament that starts next week. Two FIFA officials said nothing about the Qatar winning the 2022 bid to host the World Cup. The Sunday Times newspaper in Britain reported this week it has obtained millions of documents detailing irregular payments to football officials from a former member of FIFA's executive committee, Mohammed bin Hammam of Qatar. Brazil, where the World Cup opens on June 12th in Sao Paulo, has been widely criticized for delaying and preparing stadiums and a failure to deliver other promised improvements to roads, to rails, and to airports. Government has also faced some protest over the $11.5 billion spent on the World Cup, with about $4 billion, for 12 new renovated stadiums. Well, you can follow our World Cup coverage on the Voice of America by going to Twitter if you'd like. When you get there, you can follow us at VOA Football. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. A reminder, you can find us anytime on the Internet at voanews.com. And we hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On June 3rd, 1726, Scottish scientist James Hutton, widely considered the father of modern geology, was born. Hutton expanded on the study of minerals and rocks in his publication, Theory of the Earth, in which he proposed that the Earth had developed over a long period of time rather than being created all at once. On this day in 1808, Jefferson Davis, the only president of the secessionist Confederate States of America, was born. Davis, a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, was elected to Congress and appointed Secretary of War. A strong supporter of states' rights and slavery, Davis returned to his native Mississippi when it withdrew from the Union. In 1899, Austrian composer Johann Strauss II died. Strauss is best known for his waltzes, including the Blue Danube. The composer was widely acclaimed as the king of the waltz in Europe and the United States. In 1962, a chartered Air France Boeing 707 jetliner en route from Paris to Atlanta, Georgia, crashed during takeoff, killing 130 people on board. On this day in 1989, Chinese army troops headed to Beijing to put down a huge student-led pro-democracy demonstration. Also in 1989, Iran's Grand Ayatollah Khomeini died. The Ayatollah, an Iranian Shiite leader, returned from exile in France to lead the Iranian Islamic Revolution. And on June 3, 1999, Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic agreed to end the conflict against Kosovo. That's it for today. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In light of Madagascar's successful 2013 elections and installation of a new government, the United States has lifted restrictions on provision of foreign assistance to the Indian Ocean island nation. The restrictions had been put in place following a coup d'etat in 2009. President Ari Rajaonarimanpiam's taking office and naming a new cabinet ends a political crisis that damaged the nation's economy and cost it much support in the international community. Although the United States joined other nations in cutting off direct aid to Madagascar's government, our country remained the nation's largest partner, providing more than $61 million in food security, health, and disaster assistance in 2013 alone. Approximately 150 Peace Corps volunteers served there as well. As the African Union now has lifted its suspension of Madagascar's membership, and the United States is removing all remaining coup-related aid restrictions, President Rajaonarimanpiam has been invited to attend the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit to be held in Washington this summer. Madagascar's return to democratically elected government represents an opportunity for it to make progress on strengthening democratic rights, combating corruption, and rebuilding its economy. We look forward to working productively with the nation's new leaders as they work to secure a democratic and prosperous future for the Malagasy people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.